Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Partnership Program, our guest today, Johanna Pendelson Foreman, is an expert on the relationship between food, history, culture, and life. Johanna will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Program June 5th, 2017, Washington, D.C. at the Ripley Center, presenting on the subject of Tasting Cuba, History, Hospitality, and the Foods of Memory. A special note, following Johanna's presentation on the evening of June 5th, attendees will sample Cuban foods. Johanna maintains that we learn, we understand, we communicate and solve conflict through the taste of food, and with the recent reopening of Cuba, there is much to experience.
People who have visited Cuba recently because of the opening and tourism who want to reflect on what they've tasted. But the most interesting thing about food in general is that the way we know about countries is frequently through our palates.
That, of course, was our guest today, Johanna Mendelson Foreman. Johanna is a fascinating guest, and I'm certain you'll love this interview. I learned a great deal from Johanna, who, over 20 years of experience, has become one of the leading voices on this new approach to the intersection of food, history, hospitality, culture, and even conflict. Please join me in welcoming Johanna Mendelson Foreman to the Not Old Better Show Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series. Johanna Mendelson Foreman, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Paul.
What a pleasure it is to talk to you. I have to tell you, Johanna, this subject, this really wonderful subject that you're going to be talking about on June 5th, 2017 at the Smithsonian Associates program titled Tasting Cuba, History, Hospitality, and the Foods of Memory. So again, welcome to the program, Johanna Mendelson Foreman. Tell us about this in a nice general way and tell us a little bit about you too. And then we're going to dive into these questions that I have.
Well, I think that Tasting Cuba is a program that will appeal at many levels to those people who have the historian in them, for those people who feel they are gourmands, to those people who have visited Cuba recently because of the opening and tourism, who want to reflect on what they've tasted. But the most interesting thing about food in general is that the way we know about countries is frequently through our palates. Often, especially before the jet age, most Americans learned about other cultures through the dining room, through new immigrants that came to the United States that offered their cuisines, from the Chinese to the Italian to the German. In fact, even today, Mexican food, which is so prevalent, is something that has almost become generic. And Cuban food as well is now something that everybody sees on a menu, whether it's in a fast casual chain and it's a Cuban sandwich. So that, interestingly, our ability to understand cultures, which we don't even realize, comes by eating.
And I read in my research of you and this subject, I read some interesting terms, and I wonder if you could just touch on those too. One of the terms that I thought was really interesting, it caught me immediately, and again, I just was completely naive to this, and that is this term referred to as conflict cuisine. What does that mean? I guess I've never really thought of my own kitchen as kind of a foreign policy venue, but that's kind of what this is tied to a little bit, right?
Well, food has become today not only a tool for building understanding, but it's also a tool of diplomacy. It's part of what was described as smart power, is a way of using the things that we have that are not that are cultural as a bridge to building understanding. But the specifics of conflict cuisine is that many of the foods that we are eating now, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area, the Vietnamese food, the Afghanistan food, the Ethiopian food, the Central American cuisines, are all the results of wars that the United States was involved in, either directly or as a proxy. And these cuisines, which came to our country with the refugees from these places, really helped educate the American public about the different types of needs that people coming from other cultures have. And it's become even more relevant today as the crises around the world are making it harder and harder for people to integrate. So that today, the cooking of refugees, the people who are the victims of conflicts in Syria, in Iraq, in the Sudan, in Ethiopia, people who are coming out of these wars are all bringing with them their memories in the form of the cuisine that they eat. And they're helping not only their fellow members of the same community, but also helping the public learn about the way their culture is translated into food. There's an interesting belief that in the first generation, obviously, you have the language of your country, but in the second, the memory of food is probably the strongest, even if you lose your national language. And I think we see that all over, especially in the city of Washington.
I think it exists everywhere, too. Maybe like you, but I come from an immigrant family. My family immigrated from Holland during World War II. My grandmother, as a Dutch Jew, escaped kind of the Nazi occupation. And to this day, my dad, he still cooks. And food is very important to him. So when times were tough, his family kind of turned to food. And as I grew up, life around the table was this big conversation and discussion. And maybe that's part of this too, but my father still makes some of the foods from, his mother, my grandmother, of pancakes and mm-hmm. these Dutch waffles. And those are important recipes to our family. So all of this seems to be a natural springboard into this idea of diplomacy.
Well, it's interesting, and you mentioned the Holocaust, but in Terezin, one of the concentration camps, there is a Terezin cookbook. And it's not because victims of the Holocaust were able to cook, but many of the women who were in their dormitories would actually write down, if they could find a scrap of paper, recipes and talk about their favorite foods. And some of this survived and was transcribed. So that food has this tremendous power of connecting people that might otherwise have class differences or ideological differences. It is a way of coming together. And, you know, even our own holiday like Thanksgiving, where we talk about the fights that family have at the Thanksgiving table, are often mitigated by the collective memories of the foods that their relatives prepared. And coming around the table is ancient. It's something that the Romans used. It's something that the Greeks used. The ability to talk over food is a very powerful tool. And we see it even in the White House dinners that are held. We see it in the social dinners that we go to. I don't know if you realize today there is even a movement called 100 Days, 100 Dinners, where people get together with political differences, and this happened after the election, to try and agree to listen. And when you're eating, often you're able to listen. There's also the phenomena, and I think this is interesting, it's not directly related to Cuban food, but I asked a young millennial writer, I said, why is your generation so interested in food? And I think it's because food is tangible. It's something you do with other people, whereas most of our lives are today spent in front of screens most of the day. We look at our computers. We look at our phones. We don't use our hands except to type. So when you cook, you actually use your hands. You have to interact. You have to touch ingredients. So food provides this tangible relationship with something real.
We're with Johanna Mendelson-Forman. Johanna is going to be at the Smithsonian Associates June 5th, 2017 at the Ripley Center talking about Tasting Cuba, the History, Hospitality, and the Foods of Memory. What are food memories that come from Cuba? Tell us a little bit about that. Are they specific foods? Are they feelings? Are they conversation? How does that all kind of interweave?
That's a great question. The idea behind this program really came as an inspiration from my students' work at American University. I had them map different cuisines in the region, and one of my students was a Cuban-American, and she said, I'm going to map Cuban food. And what she pointed out is something I knew as an academic, and that is that food is dynamic. And just the way you talk about your grandmother's food being transformed by your father and your own interpretations, Cuban food has many generations of, or iterations would be a better word, where the first generation that came here in the 60s after Castro took over the government is what I call the food of nostalgia, where people are recreating the food they ate around the dinner table. Then you know, after that, when the Soviets came into Cuba and there were, you know, more imported foods from the Eastern Bloc, you had this whole generation of people who were schooled in the eastern part of Europe and had a taste for Russian canned goods. So you have stores in Miami today that specialize in importing food from Eastern Europe and Russia because people still love the taste of the canned sardines or the canned beets. You also have a newer generation of people who came over during the Mariel boat lift. Their food is different than the food of nostalgia because there was already scarcity in Cuba. So they use many of the same ingredients, but the way they cook it, the access to oil, the access to sugar, because everything was rationed, is different. And so they prepare foods in different ways. Now, of course, everybody made traditional Cuban sandwiches, but they didn't even have meat in some cases. So they made variations of this. The things that were plentiful are obviously more present in those foods. You had the next movement of Cubans coming here, the balseros, the people who came in the rafts. And those folks in the 90s were even more subject to scarcity. There was a special period, and that was a time of great starvation. The average Cuban lost about 20 pounds during that time. This was after the Soviets cut them off. Russia became a country. The exports from Russia ended, and Cuba was on its own. And through very bad policy planning on the part of the Cubans were literally starving to death. That came to an end, and then you had a new generation, which is really the generation that became more of an entrepreneurial class and said, okay, you know, we're in this environment, the embargo isn't going to end, but we're going to figure out ways to get different kinds of foods in. And this is when you had the entrepreneurial class creating what we know as paladares. These are the restaurants that were built inside people's home. The government regulated them quite strictly at the beginning, saying you could only have 12 guests and the workers had to be members of the family. That movement today has grown into a much bigger movement. And finally, you have this whole generation in Miami, which is really a place where the refugees from Cuba went and continue to go because of the policies that we've had, which allow Cubans to come in under a special waiver so they get their green cards, although that's just ended. And that generation has created what I would say is a fusion of all these different trends, but also using the plenty of the American kitchen to make these dishes that, you know, use the tastes, but also make them richer, that fuse the Asian cuisine in them. And also, people forget that Cuba is a country where the Afro-Cuban cuisine is a very important part of the meal. Slavery was in Cuba the longest, except for Brazil, and the food of Africa very much comes up among the Afro community and is integrated into Cuban cuisine. So you have a melange of what is, on the one hand, universal food of the African population throughout the Western Hemisphere and also the Spanish cooking. And then the creativity of new chefs who are trying to use many different techniques to make the best of what is now becoming a highly developed cuisine, even down to molecular cuisine if you go to Havana these days.
One of the terms that I've read that you use is this idea of Cuban foodways. What does that term mean, and what's the historical importance of that?
Well, I think Cuba had many migrations. Mm-hmm. In addition to the Spaniards who first came, there was an indigenous population, though unfortunately the indigenous died out from Western European diseases. The African population, which was brought in from the slave trade, is still very much a part of the Cuban population as a free African population that has remained in Cuba. And the foodways of the slave plantations from the sugar plantations is still very much predominant in some areas of the country, which are rural, although all the sugar mills were closed down in the mid-2000s. And then you have the foodways. I mean, it's a term that anthropologists use to describe the different means and methods of eating. So you have different traditions in different parts of the country that are, you know, as I say, very predominant in using Spanish cuisine, lots of rice, lots of beans, but also very unique, with lots of use of tropical fruits, guava, malanga, which is taro root, pineapple. Cubans like food very sweet, and there is a tremendously important coffee culture in Cuba, which in Washington is now represented by the opening of a new shop called the Colada Shop. Because Cubans drank their espresso coffee in a colada, a group of people who would share one espresso in little thimble-like containers. So there are many different types of traditions in the Cuban cuisine, which are part of what we call Cuban foodways.
So what is maybe an opinion or tell us kind of a general understanding on your part of this idea that maybe food builds peace. Is that something that is part of the State Department activity? Well, got to be a goal.
Yeah. In Cuba, here's the problem. You have this very divided society between those who receive remittances and have dollars and those who don't. Until the embargo is ended, the segregation of the Cuban society between those who have and have not will remain very clear. Let me say, nobody starves in Cuba. But those people who don't get remittances rely on subsidies by the state. And I've been told in interviews I've done that those subsidies don't last the full month. There are these stores that the government runs where you get your supply of sugar and you get your supply of flour. You even get cigars. But the problem is that these supplies are very, you know, short-lived. And in fact, there are many soup kitchens in communities where the elderly or children don't get enough food and they go to soup kitchens. Those who have get food through what I would call these black market environments and supermarkets that take dollars. And that's, in some ways, I think the dividing line, which makes it in what I would describe a conflict cuisine, in that the embargo has created this dichotomy in what was once supposed to be this egalitarian and socialist state. And it's very evident when you go as a tourist to Cuba, you have access to all of these private restaurants, and there are multiple restaurants. I think there are between 300 and 500, some people count, of private dining rooms, some of which are very elegant. They are able to grow their own vegetables. They have money to bring things. They call it the Samsonite economy because they send people, to believe it or not, to Costco in Miami or Costco in Cancun, and people bring in suitcases full of contraband food like chocolate and dried fruits, which aren't available in Cuba. Because in Cuba, the food supplies are managed by a military concession. And if you don't have access to this, then you have to work on the black market.
Joanna, I know on the night of the presentation at Smithsonian Associates, June 5th, we're going to be having a little bit of a tasting. Tell our audience a little bit about that and what that involves.
Well, of course, that's the best part of the evening because everybody likes to have a nice plate of food in front of them. It's part of the benefit of being a member. But we're going to have a very traditional Cuban dish, which is called ropa vieja. It means basically old clothes, but it's a beef dish of a simmered piece of meat in a wonderful tomato and onion sauce. It's served with rice. I think we'll have fried bananas with that. I also know that we're going to have some appetizers that are prepared by one of the restaurants for us. And exciting is the fact that we're going to have some of the wonderful Cuban drinks. The mojito, the classic drink of Cuba, which is crushed mint and lime and lots of sugar and rum, that is going to be prepared by one of the best Cuban bartenders in the area. And of course, there'll be desserts, which are going to be sweet. There'll be rice and there'll be guava, but I think everybody will be very happy and not be hungry at the end of the evening.
Well, it just is a fascinating subject. I know you're going to tell this story in a fascinating way, too. And we're going to have some good food to eat. How can we go wrong?
No.
Joanna Mendelson-Forman, thank you so much for joining us today. And please give us a last word. Tell us, I don't mean to interrupt.
Well, as we would say with eating, buen provecho, happy appetite. So I think this program offers a way of, through our palates, tasting what is so important, and that is a way of building community in the Americas.
I'm going to be there on June 5th. I look forward to meeting you, Joanna, and I am excited to make sure that my audience hears this message and joins you too. So again, Joanna Mendelson-Forman will be at Smithsonian Associates June 5th, 2017 at the Ripley Center Tasting Cuba, History, Hospitality, and the Foods of Memory. Joanna, thank you very much. I understand you're going to be traveling, so safe travels. Come back to us, and we'll see you on June 5th.
Great. I look forward to it, Paul. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.